We are talking about King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, and in particular, we're talking about his most famous quality, his wisdom, which he was identified with by his father, David, early on. He was identified as an Ish Chacham, a wise man, or, you may have noticed in the title that I've called this The Power and Peril of Genius. We noted last time that genius isn't exactly the same thing as wisdom, and when we translate chokhmah, we usually translate it as wisdom, and then it sounds like something distinct from smarts or brilliance. But we started to get a sense, especially from the famous story of splitting the baby, the most famous King Solomon story, where the two women, and if you didn't know this, many of us startled to realize that the women were prostitutes who lived in the same house, and maybe that explains some of why they were suddenly both pregnant and yet not exactly amicable relations between them. But that story is meant to demonstrate Solomon's wisdom, and we talked a little bit about what it is that makes him so wise in that moment. Is it psychological wisdom? Does he understand the human heart? Or is he just brilliant? And tonight, I want to make the case that very strongly that whatever it was that Solomon had, it was more than just the sort of wise, sagely understanding that we associate with wisdom, but that actually the guy was a mega genius. At least that's what we're supposed to understand, and part of the reason for that, and this we also saw, this is the last, I think, piece of information that we'll need to be ready today, we also saw last week that Solomon had been identified early on as an Ish Chacham, a person who was wise, and it seemed like when David was encouraging Solomon to use his wisdom, that wisdom was directed towards strategic thinking, specifically to kill the right people, to make sure that he rewarded the allies and did away with the enemies that David had. So that wisdom seemed like cunning and guile as much as anything else. And that's another word that we can put on our list. We have now wisdom and we have brilliance. And then we have some kind of strategic shrewdness is one of the ways that it was translated. So I guess I also just wanted to start just getting us thinking about what kind of person we're looking at here by asking you to think of the smartest person you know. Like, who is the smartest person you know? And you don't have to name them, although you can. But I'd love to hear some examples of the smartest person you know. Why are they the smartest person you know? What can they do so impressively? I hang out a lot in, like, yeshiva circles, so I think of people who just sort of cite things, you know? They seem to have the entire Talmud memorized, and they just spit it forth. So that's a certain kind of intelligence, is the capacity of the brain to hold information, to memorize, hold information, and be able to give it back out. Are there other examples of just the smartest person you know, the most impressive kind of intelligence that you can think of? Yeah.
My roommate is an astrophysicist.
Okay. And what is so impressive? So that's an impressive title. What is impressive about her knowledge or his knowledge?
She's just, like, understands how the universe works mathematically in a way that is so inconceivable to, I think, most people who are not astrophysicists.
Okay, good. So she has access to a certain kind of knowledge that very few people have, and that's also impressive. So not just a recall, but a kind of, a layer of knowledge that is unusual.
And, like, fundamental truths that you can prove on paper, like, that are math.
Yeah. About math. Right, it's not just an arcane kind of,
it's
like,
just knowledge, like, you can formulate an argument, which, like, I very much appreciate, but it's, like, you can actually prove it.
Good. Okay. Yeah.
I'm not thinking of the smartest person I know because I don't really know who that is, but I'm thinking of what might make someone smart, and I go back to that old tried and true Jewish phrase, I think it's from Pirkei Avot, Ezehu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam. Who is a smart person? One who learns from each person. And I guess that's also partly my social work background.
Yeah. So that's a good... That's an interesting definition, one that we get from our sages, and it seems there that wisdom or smarts is associated with a certain kind of intellectual curiosity or willingness to absorb information, which is, on the one hand, could have something to do with brain capacity, but also it's attitudinal. There's something about that that's like an orientation.
From a social work perspective, it's a sense that each person has value and something to communicate that's important to listen to.
Good, good. And one could ask, could we, when the sages are telling us that, are they expecting that we should all orient ourselves in that way? We could all be smart in that way if we wanted to? Or no, is that a kind of quality that, like memory, is just the unique gift of some? Yeah, a couple more answers.
So another type of brilliant person is people I've run across who are able to see connections and synthesize completely new concepts by seeing connections from over here and over there and put it together, which is a different type of wisdom than somebody who can just do immediate memory recall and pull out a bunch of facts that nobody else could possibly remember. And I've always been amazed at the ability of some of these people to see these connections and synthesize completely new concepts.
Great. That's great. That's a great other kind of brilliance. And I don't know, I might use the word analytical brilliance as a, you might use a different one?
Our rabbi gave he was talking about Moshe. When he was bringing in hiring a bunch of judges, and he made the distinction between chokhmah and bina. As being chokhmah is more being able to remember a lot of stuff, and bina is being able to see connections between.
Okay, good. And then that might work with some of what we were saying earlier, understanding the connection between one thing and another. Okay, great. In the back.
I think that it's a combination, like what you said, but the ability to see things from a completely new perspective in a completely different way, but it has to come also with the willingness and the ability to do the rigorous work in order to make it real or have the substance. And many people just have only one of them. So having this combination is, I think Maimonides had it, but it's rare.
Good. Okay, I'm throwing words to describe what you're talking about. You can correct me if they're the wrong words. But it sounded like something, a certain kind of creative thinking. But then by the end, it sounds like you're also talking about a certain kind of courageous thinking, a willingness to take ideas and run with them. Do you want to correct that at all?
No, it's also work, but yes, you need courage because you get pushback.
Okay. Okay. And then in the far back.
I don't know, but Bill Clinton, I feel like he was like knowledgeable of the world and academic. He has like a very strong emotional intelligence.
Uh-huh. Right. Emotional. And we speak about multiple intelligences. That's like Howard Gardner educational language. And that's worth thinking. That's the kind of thinking I want us doing. People chuckle. Anytime you mention like a name, it's like, oh, all the political associations here. But I do want us thinking about figures like Bill Clinton. I mentioned a different kind of figure, Putin, last time, who has got clearly a certain kind of brilliance. And so do most of our political leaders, even the ones we hate, have a certain kind of brilliance, but they're different kinds of brilliance. Okay, let's take a look at King Solomon. And this, we saw last time him get that knowing heart. We saw him do impressive things. So let's take a look at this first source here. This, I think, is the ultimate expression of Solomon's, well, chokhmah, although you'll see there immediately that word tvunah, like related to Bina, is there as well. Vayiten Elokim chokhmah leShlomo, God endowed Solomon with chokhmah, wisdom, utfunah harbe me'od, and discernment or understanding in great measure. And here's, the heart is going to come up again and again, verochav lev, kachol asher al sfatayam, and a wide heart, literally, a breadth of understanding, but a wideness of heart as vast as the sands of on the seashore. Okay, so there's three. We've just been naming different kinds of smarts. Here's three different kinds. And Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all Bnei Kedem, of all the Kedemites, and than all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Remember that Pharaoh had wise men around him, right? So there's some idea, and they could do things. So there's some idea that There's wisdom out there, but Solomon's is the greatest. He was wiser than anybody else, including, and I like this, including Rav Eitan. He was smarter even than our Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Eitan. Eitan Ezrachi. He was smarter than Ethan the citizen, Ethan the Ezrachite. And Heman, of course. No, and Heman and Kachol and Darda and the sons of Machol, and his fame spread among all the surrounding nations. Okay, and now, so we've got some adjectives. Now let's take a look at what he can do. He composed 3,000 proverbs. Vaydaber shloshet alafim mashal. And this is here we get the sense, we get a connection to the one of the books attributed to Solomon. He could, mashal is like we call it proverbs, but could be like metaphors or parables or examples. Yeah, good. He composed 3,000 proverbs and his songs. That's interesting. And again, there's another book connection, right? Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, attributed to Solomon, and his songs numbered 1,005. And there is perhaps some creative artistic intelligence. He's the smartest of all, and so he was composing songs. He was in his, you know, room with the guitar or the lute or whatever it was. He discoursed about trees. That's interesting. Vaydaber al ha'etzim. He talked about trees from the cedar in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. Do you know this person? My stepfather is like this. When we go for a hike, he's just like, and this plant is this, and this plant is this. And that's a certain kind of awe-inspiring intelligence. And he discoursed, although I'm not saying that's what this is. I guess I want to wonder with you what this is. And he discoursed about beasts and birds and creeping things and fishes. People came from all peoples, Mikol Amim, to hear Solomon's wisdom. Lishmoa et chochmat shlemo, to hear Solomon's wisdom, and sent by all the monarchs of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So, does he remind you of the person that you were thinking of? What is this wisdom? What can he do that is so astounding here? Yeah.
He has knowledge of things.
Good. Yeah, he has knowledge of what kinds of things?
The environment and stuff around him.
The natural world.
He has a lot of wisdom. He's like observant of the whole world.
Good. Okay, good. And some of that knowledge, as you said, is like naturalistic, not necessarily the wisdom that we would have assumed he needed in order to rule over a people or to memorize passages in the Talmud. This is like he knows science. Is it science? But there's something like observational about it. Yeah.
Now, what was striking me was how much this passage harkens back to Bereishit, because this is the language of
Christ. Right.
He has a relationship not only to creation, but also to a certain extent to Avraham Avinu. Because there's a line in Genesis 12 about descendants being like the dust, like as numerous as the dust
yeah.
and the sand.
Yeah, that's nice.
It's not this language, but it's close.
Right.
So there's a lot that Solomon is imbued with to sort of remind us.
I love that connection, both of the connections you're making. First of all, just the hearkening to whatever vastness it is, we described it as like dust or stars or sand, it's that vast. But you're right, the references to the ha'of, the bird, and especially you're reminded of it when the haremes, the creeping thing, and the fish, it's like he has knowledge of the natural world, but there's something about knowledge of what we call maaseh bereishit is like, that's not just the natural world that gets to your roommate. That's like how everything came to be. And remember, that's not just nature in our story. That's God's work. So he understands that, perhaps? Okay, good. Yeah.
I would argue that he really has it all, according to this text. He has all these multiple intelligences. It's not just that he has breadth as as is metaphorized by the reference to the sand, but it's granular.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does he know enough words to write songs and parables, but he has enough emotional intelligence to put something into them.
Right. Right, and when we think of, you say emotional intelligence, when we think of the song we associate with him, the Song of Songs, it's like deep emotional understanding of love. And, you know, there's a psychological, there's a creative, I think you're saying it well. There's like all the categories of knowledge. He seems like he can kind of do it all. Yeah, beautifully put. A couple more folks heard from.
I feel like all of this, as impressive as it is, it isn't really wisdom. It doesn't feel like wisdom.
Yeah.
To me, because wisdom feels to me like sort of, you know, being able to give advice, being able to know what to do in a situation that's good for a person and that's good for the world and that there's a positive valence about it.
Yeah.
And this is just like, I mean, obviously there wasn't any way you could read about this stuff in a book necessarily, as people are saying.
Yeah.
But still, it feels much more intellectual and less wisdom.
Yeah, good, good. And that's why I said at the outset, we're going to see him real. I mean, this is genius. I mean, this is a genius, clearly. This is brilliance, but I think you're right to distinguish it from, it doesn't seem like you're in awe of the songs, perhaps notwithstanding. Maybe there's some kind of emotional awareness there, but it doesn't seem like wisdom in the sense that, in the classical sense, that we associate with a certain kind of broad philosophical understanding, and perhaps that he demonstrated in that moment when he called to split the baby, there was something he understood about the way human beings work. But this is really knowing stuff, having skills, lots of different kinds of knowledge. This is genius. Okay, just one more, yeah.
I was also curious about that because it seems like the primary way he's talking about his intelligence is through his understanding of this natural world. But people are still coming to seek wisdom from him.
Right.
It's still something that he's imparting that's relevant, but it's not the primary way they're describing how he relates to anybody else or like. Yeah. What is his level of humility in this understanding of things?
Good. Okay, good. And that is an important question. That's an important question we're just going to carry through the like, what is his level of humility, and can one hold humility with this kind of super mega genius? Now, you note correctly that people are coming all over the world to, but it's to hear his wisdom, to hear him. Well, okay, let's see. Let's take an example. The most esteemed example of someone who comes to see his wisdom, and that is Malkachva, the queen of Sheba. And here's where things start to get, I don't want to say go off the rails yet, though we will go off the rails. Here's where they start to get a little funny, a little suspicious. Like there's something, I can't put my finger on it, maybe you'll help me, but there's something about this exchange that makes me, I don't know, a little uncomfortable, okay? The queen of Sheba, Malkachva, shemat et shema Shlomo. She heard about the fame, the word on the street. And then there's a phrase I don't quite know what to do with. In the name of God, l'shem Hashem. I'm not sure exactly how to translate that. It said the queen of Sheba, the translation I got from the internet, the queen of Sheba heard of Solomon's fame for the name of God, but that didn't make sense to me. But anyway, l'shem Hashem. God is in there somehow. And she came, v'tavo lenasoto b'chidot. And she came to test him with chidot, which I've translated here as like riddles. That's a good translation, but chida is like something mysterious, some kind of secret questions they had it translated. She came to test him with questions, but it's more than just questions. It's some kind, you want to, what's that?
Conundrums.
Okay, fine. Okay, good. So that in itself is like, what is she saying? We never get an example, but she's testing him with chidot. Okay. She arrived in Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels bearing spices, a great quantity of gold and precious stones. An impressive lady. When she came to Solomon, she spoke to him all that she had in her heart. And there's the word heart again, which is moving throughout the Solomon story. So let's just take note of that. V'tedaber alav et kol asher haya im livava. Everything that was with her heart, that was in her heart, she spoke to him. And then the response here is interesting too. And again, the translation doesn't quite capture it. Solomon had answers for all her questions. That's not exactly what it says. Vayeged la Shlomo et kol dvareha. Solomon then spoke over to her all of her words, all of her matters. Again, I'm not sure exactly how to translate it, but it's not he had answers for her questions. He spoke to her, and this I return again to Jody's suggestion from last time, that part of what he got is an ability to listen and repeat back. So she came to him with chidot, and then he spoke back to her words. I'm not sure what to make of that. There was not...
From social work, it's reflective listening.
Reflective listening. Okay, so maybe that Lev Shomea really does... Yeah.
But it's probably one step more. It's probably understanding what her real problem or real concern was beyond what she was just telling him. It was getting, right? And just like in
Good.
Gamora, what's the Stom's voice from affair? What are they really talking about? I feel like that's what Shlomo is doing.
Right. Why doesn't it say, Vapatar la et kol achidot? He solved all the, you know, like he, you know, he knew how to like identify the all of the SAT questions. He could like solve it. No, there's something like she comes with riddles and he gives her back something else maybe that she needed, because after all, she did also give him everything that was on her heart or in her heart.
Yeah. Goes to some kind of a metamorphosis, a change. She comes basically to stomp him. Chidot is what they did to Shimshon, to Samson, in order
right.
to...
Right, right, good connection.
She comes to stomp him, but as they talk, and he managed to answer her riddles, but she opens her heart to him, right. and she gets inspired and awed, not because he solved the riddles, but because he saw into her in some way.
Okay, all right. So first of all, again, I love the way you speak out an interpretation, because at first, you're giving me one thing, and then you take me in a direction that I didn't expect. So, and on the one hand, that's right that to a certain extent he is able to not just solve her problems, but to speak to some kind of inner understanding. But also the idea that like he builds some kind of relationship. He's able to sort of make a connection that isn't just about solving the problems that she came with, but something else is going on. And one must wonder, does it have something to do with the heart? Is there a kind of, like, you got this big, powerful king and this big, powerful queen, and, are we heading into is there, like, an air of romance in the air? All right, I'll take these comments, but let's just continue to see what happens. When the queen observed all of Solomon's wisdom, kol chochmat shlemo, v'habayit asher bana, and the palace that he had built. She comes with a lot of stuff, he's got a lot of stuff. That also seems like part of the picture. It's like we keep mentioning that. The food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service and attire of his attendants and his wine service, and the burnt offerings that he offered at the house of God. And then listen to this. This is in the Hebrew. V'lo aya ba'od ruach. She was breathless. She had no... That was it. She was breathless. That is the best. That really is the best way. She was left breathless. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own land about you and your wisdom was true. Emet hayah davar, it was true. But I didn't believe the reports until I came and saw with my own eyes that not even the half had been told to me. Your wisdom and wealth surpassed the reports I had heard. How fortunate are your people, and how fortunate are these, your servants, your courtiers, who are always in attendance on you and can hear your wisdom. Praise be the Eternal, your God, who has delighted you and set you on the throne of Israel. It is because of God's everlasting love for Israel that you were made king, lasot mishpatutzka, to administer justice and righteousness." Okay, we haven't seen a lot of that here, but that is what he wanted, was to be able to administer justice. So she's impressed, and she presented the king with 120 talents of gold and a large quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again did such a vast quantity of spices arrive as that which the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. What did she see? What so impressed her here? What was it? What's going on? What do you think is going on here? We've heard already some answers that maybe he connected to her. He understood what she was saying. She started out with puzzles, but he gave her some kind of deeper connection. But now there's like she's given a whole speech about how great it is, and she didn't believe it, but my goodness, now that I'm here and I see all of your stuff and all of your, like, there's like a lot in here. So what is she seeing that is so overwhelming? Yeah.
I think that she sees that he sees consequences. That his wisdom, I mean, they're always unintended consequences, but to the degree that consequences are discernible, I think that that's part of wisdom, and I think that that's part of what she sees.
Okay, so it isn't, he's able to talk to her and prove this is a brilliant guy, but also look at what he's done with it. The palace itself is a kind of testament, and the court around him is a kind of testament to what he can do. It's not just that I one-to-one am impressed with, but you've built something here, and as a queen, maybe especially, I can appreciate that. Yeah.
So I think she's smitten with him on two levels, both personally and monarch to monarch. And I think one way of reading this is to say that back at the beginning of this passage, she goes with two things. She goes with a bunch of stuff, and she goes with a plan to ask him riddles. What does she do? She gives him a bunch of stuff. She never asks the riddles. Instead, he sees her, and he starts telling her after he gets her to tell him everything that's on her mind.
Yeah, that's an interesting read that you're giving us there. Maybe she never even posed the riddles. Instead, she spoke to him everything that was on her heart, like immediately, I don't know, seduced in all of the ways, like seduced by the wealth and the power and maybe by some kind of connection. I saw a hand over there, yeah.
So I'm also struck by it's about how he treats his servants, how he treats his attendants. It's like from, and his relationship with God. So it's from almost like the, it's a bad word, but like the lowly people to the most on high, how he cares for people and how he interacts with those around him. He puts attention and time into that.
Good. Some of this stuff really is, I mean, this is stuff we're supposed to be impressed with. She even praises God. That's like, good. This, you know, this guy's in Tanakh. Like, that's, you know, God's got to be in the picture. This, like, that's the kind of thing you want our leaders to be admired for. So, yeah, the way that he deals with his servants, right? The way that he administers justice. And she has not just been impressed with him, but he's somehow summoned with her in an admiration for all that we hold dear. So that's a, this seems like, so there's what to be suspicious of here in all kinds of ways, but there's some of this stuff is clearly good stuff. This is like the kind of stuff that we're always pushing for in our tradition. Yeah.
So, like, what's happening, like, politically? Is Sheba some type of, is she seeing if maybe he might be some type of a threat? In other words, like, I don't know, like, politically what's happening here.
Right.
Is Sheba some type of...
Yeah, I don't know. Does anyone have a better sense of, like, what the particular... What's clear is that there's an alliance being forged here, and it's an alliance of wealth and power. What role she in particular holds, I don't know. Any of my colleagues or just folks in the room want to... weigh in on that?
So this isn't your history textbook, obviously, but the way that the Tanakh positions Solomon is that he is the most important local leader while the Egyptians are the main power and the main source of wisdom literature, which is why they come up so often.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, a section of Sefer Mishle is basically cribbed from a famous Egyptian wisdom text.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of admiration for Egypt without, you know, becoming, uh-huh, you know, idolatrously, uh-huh, Egyptian, uh-huh, in the text.
But
that's kind of where we are. Yeah. Egypt is more important than Mesopotamia.
And is Sheba part of Egypt?
She's from further south. From
Yeah. Yeah, more like Ethiopia is what we associate with her. So maybe what you're saying is there are powers in the region, powers that are admired and feared, and Shlomo is billing alliances around them that secures him as a greater power. So this is, it's important that he be able to impress here.
She's testing to see how weak or strong he might be.
Mm-hmm. Right. In other words, there's a political, potentially military alliance being forged here as well. Yeah. Please.
I was going to say, it's like also like a trade relationship, because, I mean, Israel needed me with the goods and the services, and he was reaching to Lebanon to build.
Well, that's right.
So he needed to go with me and the spices. He wanted to establish trade.
That's right. I mean, Shlomo is in the process of building a palace, building a house for God, and, you know, needs materials, is constantly importing materials, and the wealth here is not incidental. And the fact that she rewards his wisdom with stuff, she's impressed with his stuff and rewards his wisdom with more stuff, that's also kind of threaded through this. Yeah.
So we know from sociological studies that we think people are smarter when they are more beautiful, when they are wealthier, when they have more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little bit of a negative to me, almost a nefarious quality to what's going on here, because we think she's thinking more about all of that in the context of him having all of this wealth.
Yeah, yeah. Great. And one more in the back there. You, yeah.
Well, maybe my Jewish insecurity, it just makes me feel like she came not expecting much because he's the king of Israel and how impressive he can be, and she was, you know, pretty well. The fact that they traded stuff seems to me that was what was done in those days. You know,
yeah.
People came down to Egypt and gave stuff to them. They give each other stuff.
Right.
That's how they negotiate or how they agree or make peace.
Good. Okay, this is, among other things, certainly a testament to Israel at its glory. At like the most, Solomon's kingdom is more impressive than David's kingdom. It is more opulent. This is as powerful and beautiful, splendid, as we have ever been. And there is a little bit, there is always, and we'll see soon, there's always a little bit of a reference to how are the nations around us seeing us? Are we really, do we really have status in the eyes of the world? And clearly here, this is a testament to that. Before we leave Sheba here, I have to note this one odd, as she's starting to go away, she gives him everything and she gives him so much. And then Vamelech Shlomo, he gives her as well, Natan Lamalkat Sheva, et kol chafsa, asher sha'ala. He gave her everything that she wanted. Everything that she wanted, in addition to what King Solomon gave her out of his royal bounty. That language, like everything that she wanted, what did he give her there? What did he give her there? And then she and her attendants left and returned to her own land. So there's all kinds of like midrashic speculation. What did she want? What did she want? I read this attributed to the Arizal, the great kind of Kabbalist, 16th century Svat. The Arizal said that what she wanted was to be with him, to sleep with him, and that they did, and that what came out of that union was Nebuchadnezzar, was the eventual king that would destroy the kingship of Israel. Okay, but that's like just a way of being suspicious, of speculating on like what exactly is going on here. But there's something like she gives him so much stuff and then he's willing to give her everything she wants. And there's something about this that doesn't feel exactly like just a trade arrangement here. Yeah, you want to sneak in that?
Well, I really appreciate the alliance. And that word keeps sticking in my mind. Because when I first read this, I heard that, okay, is there something romantic? Does she want something more romantic from him? But I'm reading it as, like, she's playing to him. Like, she recognizes, she's playing to his humility, right? Or, like, maybe his lack of humility. And he's, like, showing her how amazing and how smart she is. And she's not breathless because she's like, oh my God, you're amazing. She's like, oh, you're proud. And I'm going to tell you, I know you're proud. Maybe I'm reading too much.
Oh, that's interesting. You read her manipulating him.
Wow, you really are amazing, King Shlomo. Like, look at what you've done. It is so amazing. So, like, he's kind of seduced by her. And then, of course, he can give her everything she wanted.
Okay, that reading is interesting. But I think valid because we are going to see that Shlomo has, to say the least, a problem with romance, to put it politely. Okay, so this is the first hint that we have here that maybe like relationships with foreign women are a part of, she's seducing him, the part of the story here, and maybe, right, I haven't thought of it in that way, but I like thinking of it that way, that she's so impressed with his wisdom, but actually she's got a thing or two up her sleeve, yeah.
I just want to add to that, so, like, someone I think said, she's mentioning how well he, like, treats his servants, but she's not saying, I notice, like, your friendships or how you treat your family. Like, this man is lonely because he's such a genius and he's so smart, right? And she says, oh, I can, like, play into your loneliness and insecurity and flatter you, and that's not going to get it.
I like the way you put that. This man is lonely. First of all, it's lonely at the top.
Yeah.
Like, it must be strange to be the most powerful man in your nation. But also, like, it's lonely to be brilliant. Mm-hmm. And many brilliant people are lonely. And there's something about that, too. We're thinking about the power and peril of genius. And genius isn't always an easy thing to carry here. So maybe there's something, oh, you know, men and women and powerful and good-looking men and women, we can sort of, like, titter about that. But there's also some kind of connection between people of great discernment that maybe is deeply meaningful here, that there's a reason that he's drawn to her, because after all, she's a person who can come and pose chidot. She's no dummy herself, and maybe she may be much more than that. All right, now I want to start doing something, which we'll do for the rest of our time together, which is taking a look at this story. I want to consider this story in light of some of the things that we have heard in the Torah, and particularly in Sefer Devarim, in the book of Deuteronomy. Okay? She has been impressed with his wisdom. She's been impressed with his ability to execute justice and righteousness. And she's been impressed with all of his stuff. Well, the truth is, if you flip the page, it seems that the Torah encourages us to display a certain kind of wisdom that will be impressive to the nations around us. So I just want to take a look at this short passage in the beginning of Deuteronomy. We're just starting Sefer Devarim. Some of the ways, here the word again, chokhmah, comes up, and again the word binah, okay? So, re'eh, see, I have imparted to you laws and rules, chukim u'mishpatim, as my God the Eternal has commanded me for you to abide by in the land that you are about to enter and occupy. Ushmartem v'asitem, and observe them and do them, ki hi chokhmatchem uvinatchem. Because that will be proof of your, that will be, literally, your wisdom and your binah, le'ene ha'amim asher yishmun et kol ha'chukim ha'ele, in the eyes of all of the peoples around you who will hear all of these laws and rules, all of these rules. Va'amru, and they will say, rak am chacham v'navon ha'goy ha'gadol hazeh. Wow! What, surely, this is a great, this great nation is a wise and discerning people. For what great nation is there that has had a God so close at hand as is our eternal God whenever we call? Or what great nation has rules, chukim, umishpatim tzadikim, and just laws as perfect as all this Torah that I set before you today? Okay, so we're supposed to look smart. We're supposed to be admired by people around us for our chokhmah and our binah. So now I just want to ask, is Shlomo fulfilling that? Is this what we read in the Torah that we are being encouraged to display to the nations all around us? Did Shlomo achieve that? Is what we just read with Shlomo and the Queen of Sheba a kind of a version of this? Or is this different in some way than what we just saw? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, it's not clear that whether Shlomo only displays his own brilliance or whether he educates any of his people to be brilliant as well. It's not clear how much it transfers over to people.
Okay, good. Okay, so first of all, the whole nation is to be admired here. What kind of goy gadol, what kind of great people is this? And Shlomo is admired for being Shlomo. Okay. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I certainly don't think he can be the paradigm of observing laws and being consistent with the, because he violates the only two laws that are given.
Ah, so we're going to get there. Teaser for the future.
Wisdom as the wisdom of teaching Israel to comply with the laws and what's said here in Devarim. Yes, I wouldn't have made that connection if you hadn't brought that.
Good. Okay. I appreciate that comment from Joseph, because I did want to highlight that she says you were made king to administer lasot mishpat utzdakah. So the words are in there, but in what way did he demonstrate mishpat utzdakah that she saw? And Joseph is questioning that, and it does seem that what is to be admired, what Devarim really wants people to see, is the laws, how great these laws and rules are, this justice is. Now, let's be fair to Shlomo, he did some kind of justice when he almost split the baby, and she is mentioning it, so on some level it's working. We've noted that she mentions God, she mentions justice, so maybe, but it does, again, seems like this is more about you and how impressive you are, and this does seem, the description seems a little different. Just people haven't, yeah.
Just a short thing. It's already happened right at this point in Menachem that he's already, like, impressed, like, tens of thousands of his fellow country people into, like, effectively bondage to build all of these.
That's cities, right. That's right.
So, like his whatever version of mishpatim tzedukim, that, like, he's certainly not following anything that's laid out in Deuteronomy about how a society is to be structured and how laborers are to be treated.
Good.
There's just
Good. That's a piece that I didn't bring. I sort of weighed what to bring, and that was left out. But But you're right to mention it. Shlomo conscripted thousands of people into forced labor. That also is, I mean, I am, you can tell by now, I'm like guilty of casting, you know, a suspicious eye on, you know, one of our great heroes. But that is, after all, sort of my point, is that this is one of our great heroes. I feel like we are more likely to question David HaMelech. It's a more common to think of, oh, yes, but he was a great king, but he failed also. Shlomo often gets a kind of a pass, like he was just a wise king. And yet we start to read the story, it's like, there's a lot going on here that feels a little funny when we're talking about justice and mishpat. Yeah, in the back there.
Well, I also just want to point out that, like, there's nothing in this, what feels like missing to me in this picture of a ruler is military prowess. Mm. And it seems to me like so much of the Torah, like I didn't understand last week's parsha, is focused on the Israelite like military conquests. Yeah. And you would think that the Torah so focused on military life of a nation would also say a great nation has a great military
right.
idea. But that's not at all mentioned in the first text we looked at.
Right.
And I think that like this like kind of tactical reasoning skills is kind of something I think of as being a military kind of quality, and that's kind of what King Solomon is using in this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That is an interesting point, and I'll just leave that in the air. I don't know what to do with it now, but I am immediately struck as we've just compared Shlomo to David, that David is known for his military greatness, and partially it's a testament to his courage, his willingness to be on the front lines. Shlomo, that is not Shlomo's story, right? Shlomo's a builder, an amasser, maybe a strategic thinker, but not the guy running out in front. So I think that is well noted. Okay, I'm going to take these two comments, and then we're going to move on. Yeah.
It's interesting. I sort of think that she's strategic and that she's using justice and righteousness not as a compliment, but as something that's going to maybe unsettle him because she knows that he's not quite there.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's almost like a weakening.
In other words, so you're with Dahlia in thinking that she's playing him and she's saying all the things that he wants, and you're faithful to God and you do justice. You're so great. But that there's like these are the words that he wants to hear, but he hasn't really demonstrated much of those qualities. Yeah.
What Shlomo shows her are his wisdom and his stuff. If you look at Devarim in one reading, it says that what we're supposed to do is ushmarten vasitem, be careful to do what I'm telling you, and then everyone will see your wisdom. Don't flaunt it, just do it.
Right. And just so I like the way you put it kind of humbly, just do it and don't make a big show of it. But also do what? Do the mitzvahs. Do mitzvahs. Like, what is Devarim so proud of? The Torah. The Torah, that's what Shlomo is supposed to demonstrate. Yeah, my colleague. Duty.
Like one thing, I don't know if you mentioned, or like the term tzedakah mishpat, I don't know, should check in concordance, like, but it rings the bell of Bereshit, the story of Abraham.
Right.
And this, I think it's like the famous tzedakah mishpat is that relating to Abraham Avinu, the model.
Yeah.
What it means here, I have no clue.
Good, okay. So that another way of saying, like not just doing the mitzvahs, but demonstrating the justice behind them, the wisdom of the Torah that is manifest in our just laws. Did Shlomo manifest that in the way that Avram did, in the way that Devarim here is picking up on? Okay, this is, we got to get to the great downfall, and it's coming. And you just get a hint of it here at the end of, we were reading about a queen of Sheba, Malkat Sheba, that's chapter 10 of Kings, and she goes off on her way, and then there's like a, you know, more discussion of stuff, and Shlomo continues to amass stuff. I just want you to listen here, and Joseph is already on to this track, but just listen, and this should ring a bell in your Torah ear. Okay. Vayesof Shlomo Rechev Ufrashim. Solomon assembled chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. So there's a lot of horses. Okay, but he's a king, which he stationed in the chariot towns and with the king in Jerusalem. The king made silver as plentiful in Jerusalem as stones. You've been to Jerusalem, you know that's a lot of silver. And cedars as plentiful as sycamores in the Shephelah. And Solomon's horses were procured from Egypt and Kew. The king's dealers would buy them from Kew at a fixed price. A chariot imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver and a horse 150. These in turn were exported to them by them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Arameans. That's boring. I don't need to know that detail. What is the market price of horses? Why? What? Ding, ding, ding. What is that registering in our ear? Yeah?
Conspicuous consumption.
That for sure.
Take it back to Egypt, the horse.
Don't go back to Egypt to get the horses. You're going to say the same thing. All right, let's take a look now. This really, in some ways.
Mass horses and wives.
Okay, so that's it. So this is really the most important text.
Paro had it and it was his downfall.
And Paro had horses and chariots. Yeah, that language of Rechav Ufrashim, right, is very pharaoh-like language. We saw, by the way, last week that King Solomon married who? Bat Paro, Pharaoh's daughter. Okay, so there's lots of connections there. But this in particular, and this is what Joseph was signaling earlier on, this horses from Egypt thing, okay, big deal. Like, well, I don't even know where he gets his horses from, but it's a big deal. Take a look at, and this is really the text that should be casting its shadow over the whole Solomon story. These are really texts in dialogue from later in Sefer Devarim. Ki tavol ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha v'rishta v'yishavta ba v'ma'asima alai melech k'chol ha'goyim asher sivivotai. If after you've entered the land and your God the Eternal has assigned to you and taken possession of it and settled in it, and you decide, I will set a king over me as do all the nations about me. Huge, huge debate in our tradition whether this is a commandment to appoint a king or just a concession that you can appoint a king. What is the motivation to have a king? So that's a whole discussion that we could have another time, but just so you know, there's a little bit of ambiguity here. Then you shall be free to set a king over yourself. The translation sort of plays into that and says, you can if you want to. You can be free to set, Som tasim alecha melech. It sounds like a command, but it's like, well, you can if you want. A king over yourself, one chosen by your God, the Eternal. Be sure to set, which by the way, David was, and Saul was, and Solomon was not. Okay? Or was he? I mean, God names earlier that Solomon is going to be the king, and then David, and then there's strategy that has to bring him there. Here we go. Be sure to set a king over yourself, one of your own people. You must not set a foreigner over you, one who is not your kin. Moreover, he shall not keep many horses or send people back to Egypt to add to his horses. Since the Eternal has warned you, you must not go back that way again. And he shall... So already you're like, wait a minute. He got horses from Egypt. He got... Or not. Is it a problem that... that the horses came from Egypt? Or is there a problem that you sent people back to Egypt? We'll get into that. And he shall not have many wives. He shall not have many. Velo yarbe lo nashim. Velo yasur levavo. There's the heart again. So that his heart will not turn. And lest his heart go astray, nor shall he amass silver and gold to excess. Well, that's certainly a bit of a problem. When he's sitting on his royal throne, he shall have a copy of this teaching. I hate when it translates as teaching. I always try to correct that, but it's this Torah, et Mishnei Torah Hazot, this Torah written for him on a scroll by the Levitical priests. Let it remain with him and let him read in it all of his life, so that he may learn to revere his God, the Eternal, to observe faithfully every word of this Torah as well as these laws. Thus he will not act haughtily towards his fellows or deviate from Amin HaMitzvah, from the instruction to the right or to the left, to the end that his descendants may reign long in the midst of Israel. That's it. That's what you should be concerned with. Those are the regulations for a king. Those are the things that the king should keep in mind, not to acquire too much gold and silver, not to go back to Egypt to get horses, and not to have too many wives. The guy's got a lot of gold and silver, just went back to Egypt, just got horses from Egypt. So what's coming next?
Wives.
Okay, turn the page. And wives, oh my goodness, wives. So, oh my goodness, are wives about to come next? And this is it. This is really the great downfall of Shlomo, and we shouldn't chuckle here, because this is really, like, meant to be horrifying, okay, this chapter. And, you know, many times we read, like, oh, the first 10 chapters are great, but this is the horror. But I hope we've started to get a sense that there's something that was amiss all along. There's some kind of, something like not quite right already. But if we haven't noticed it by the time we got to Egyptian horses, now it's really going to blow our minds. Yeah.
Yeah, so now to defend Shlomo a little bit, I think the way the tradition deals with this, he obviously knew the law. He couldn't have been the smartest king alive or man and not know these basic precepts. He was accumulating horses to trade to increase power. He was accumulating wives because it was the thing you did in that world to cement power and alliances. And he had the arrogance of wisdom. He thought he could do it and keep it in check. But at the end of the day, he wasn't able to. So I think that's the way. Because the rabbis can't accept that he wouldn't have known these basic precepts and then violated them. He thought he could control.
Okay, that is it. Once again, you're right on track. That is exactly where we're headed. But let's just take a pause. No, that's fine. Those are the questions. Those are the questions. But let's first get a full sense of the picture before we start asking these very important questions that ultimately the rabbis ask. So that's where we'll end. But let's just take a look at the situation here, because it really is shocking. I mean, it really is shocking. Okay. V'hamelech Shlomo ahav nashim nochriot rabot. I mean, that's just a... King Solomon loved many foreign women, in addition to Pharaoh's daughter. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Phoenician, and Hittite women. From the nations that God... Those are not random nations. From the nations that God had said to the Israelites, none of you shall join them, and none of them shall join you, lest they turn your heart away to follow their gods. Such Solomon clung to and loved. He had... It's just like, how do you even do this? He had 700 royal wives and 300 concubines, 1,000 women. It's like, what? There's no time in the year. And his wives and, but what is this language? This language is really important. And vayatu nashav et libo, and his wives tilted. They turned there's that heart again. His heart, the heart that he had, that is the wise heart, the heart that he had asked for, they turned it away. In his old age, his wives turned away Solomon's heart after gods, and he was not as wholeheartedly devoted to the eternal his God as his father David had been. Now listen, Solomon followed the Ashtaroth, the goddess of the Phoenicians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites, and Solomon did what was displeasing to God and did not remain loyal to God like his father. And then Solomon built a shrine, Lichmosh, Shikutz Moab, to Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill near Jerusalem, and one for Molech. Molech! The Torah says specifically, do not worship Molech. One to Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites. And he did the same for all of his foreign wives who offered and sacrificed to their gods. And God was angry with Solomon because his heart was away from the eternal, and the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and commanded him about this matter, not to follow other gods. He did not obey what God had commanded. And so, this is it. This is the beginning of the end. Because God said to Solomon, because you're guilty of this, you have not kept my covenant and the laws I enjoined upon you, I will tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your servants, but for the sake of your father David, I will not do it in your lifetime. I will tear it away from your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give your son one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. So a sort of like foretelling of all of the chaos and disaster that is about to be the rest of Sefer Melachim, and even to the idea that we're going to lose most of the tribes. Most of the tribes are, the whole people is going to be fractured because of this. Now, why? He had a lot of wives. Why did they cause him to worship God? What are we supposed to understand? Deuteronomy warned us, but what is the problem?
Women are bad and evil.
Is it that? Well, what is the problem?
Well, I'm not sure I'm answering the question exactly. The son of the Bari, the last three sentences, we talk about the Sefer, Mishneh Torah, Sefer Mikveh, that it should be with him all the time. We should write.
That's right.
This book. So as brilliant as you are, in order to make the right decisions, you need to remind yourself, you need to have in front of yourself what really matters.
Yeah.
And so these last three sentences talk about that if there's going to be a king, he must have this in front of him to refer to look at, to remember right from wrong.
That's right.
I'm not talking about the wide belt for a moment, but he obviously didn't do that.
Right.
He was very distracted, as brilliant as he was highly distracted about what he was really supposed to do.
Okay, good. So what is the cause? He was turned away. His heart was turned to focus on his love life instead of on the Torah, which was supposed to be by him, right, literally, but also sort of spiritually by him at all times, right? And it was supposed to keep him. You said, can he stay humble? What was Torah supposed to keep him? Keep him from being rum levavo, from being haughty of heart, haughty of heart. So part of the problem is that he forgot that the Torah, in the way that our system also has some kind of check on executive power, this is our American system. This is the Torah's check on the power of the king. Is that he's supposed to be beholden to the Torah? And he seems to have been distracted, to have forgotten about that. Richard,
from the women's perspective here, weren't they just doing what they always do in this sense of these are military, these are alliances among countries? The women of different countries are marrying into each other's families, and there's a polytheistic society. So part of what you do is you merge all these different gods, and everybody's worshiping the god of the home country, but also the god of the wife's country, and that further strengthens the alliance. Further strengthens.
Good.
So from the women's perspective, they weren't necessarily trying to get Solomon to move away from Judaism. They were just trying to do.
It's part of the deal. It's part of the deal, and you respect our gods too. And that is, I think that's right as well.
You know, going back to the original idea about the peril of genius, maybe Solomon knew these things, but he thought like, oh, that was the Egypt and Dvarim from hundreds of years ago. I mean, there's this sort of category shift. And what we're actually talking about is not like the Egypt of physical Egypt, but like spiritual Egypt.
Ah, okay. Thank you. You have given me that. I was like a little worried. We've got 3 minutes left, but you've given me the perfect segue into our last text, which again, Joseph was alluding to. And so far we've been looking at Tanakh, but here we'll dip into rabbinic thinking. And that is exactly the sort of worrying that the rabbis are doing here. As they reflect on this story, as we've been doing tonight, there's a particular issue that they think this story can teach us about, and that is Tamei Torah, maybe Tamei HaMitzvot, but the way they put it is Tamei Torah, the reasons behind the Torah. That we're told to do things, but why? Why are we told to do things? So listen to this final teaching. This is what I want to end on and hopefully reflect on a little bit, not just what it means for Solomon, but also for us and our own wisdom. Okay, so Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak says, Mipnei ma lo nitgalu tamei Torah. Why were the reasons behind the Torah, the reasons why we're supposed to do things, not revealed? Sharei, shtei mikraot nitgalu taman, nichshal behen gadol ba'olam. But because the reasons for two verses were revealed, and the greatest in the world, the greatest king in the world, failed in them. For it is written, he shall not add many wives for himself, that his heart shall turn away. That's the reason. And Solomon said, I will add many, but I will not let my heart be turned away. I will not turn away. And it is written, for it came to pass when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart away after other gods. So the rabbis see what I think we've seen, which is these texts are clearly in dialogue with one another. And it is also written, only he shall not accumulate many horses for himself, nor return the people to Egypt for the sake of accumulating horses. And Solomon said, I will accumulate many, but I will not return. And it is written, a chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver. The Tamei HaMitzvot. What are they saying about Shlomo? What was he thinking? I think you said some of it there. That these are mitzvot. They're commanded. They're commanded by God. But they're commanded in order to achieve a certain end, in order to protect us from certain things. And I will protect myself. I know what the reasons are. I'm a brilliant guy, and I know how to protect myself from getting carried away. I'll control my heart. I'll make sure I don't go astray. I'll do these things, but the problem wasn't really doing them. The problem was that if you do them, then there will be consequences that God doesn't want. Well, now that I know that, I can defend myself from those. I can protect myself from those consequences. So what is the message here? It's a sort of a strange message that they seem to be suggested that, like, we shouldn't know why we're commanded to do anything, because we're going to start we're going to start coming up with reasons not to do it. I mean, could that really be the message that it's better not to know? It's better not to know. Yeah.
I don't think you have to not know, but you can look around and see, well, how successful are people mostly at not falling down this slope? Not so much. Maybe I should just follow the way that I've been given to avoid.
Good. Okay. That, it seems to me, should work if you're just a regular person looking around at other regular people. But what happens if you are the smartest, most powerful person in the world? Then you look at other people and, yeah, they go astray, but I'm Shlomo HaMelech. I'm the smartest person there ever was. I have divine wisdom. Surely I can control myself. And it seems that the message is no, no one, no one, no one can control themselves. Let's see. Anyone not spoken yet? Yeah, Avery.
It seems that the rabbis are justifying the fences that they put around fences with this text here to say that better that you don't know and are even so worried about possibly overstepping that you are going to be even further and further away by all of these fences, and that that's the justification there. Another thought I was having here is just separate from this last piece, but just about Solomon and his Lev Shamua and also Lev Rachav, in that he has opened that up to all of his wives and to all of this, into the world that he has been a part of as like an international ambassador, as the monarch, and thus takes that divine wisdom, but instead of focusing on the justice and on the Torah, just opens it up in what we would call like emotional intelligence to his wives, which we would think of as like a kindness, but here is very much a sin.
Okay, that's an interesting point, in part because for all of your intellectual intelligence, maybe no one's immune from the sort of the lures of the heart. And maybe that's part of the message here, too. You're sort of now trying to read into the rabbis a whole way of thinking about how we relate to our law, our chukim, our laws. Chukim, by the way, especially, are considered those laws that the reasons are not revealed for them. And sometimes we say, why do we have to do these silly things? But this is like the fences and all of the securities to make sure that we just do it. Because the worry here surely is that someone in Shlomo's position might go astray, but that actually all of us have to worry about our brilliance, our intelligence, our wisdom is revered, but there is a kind of there's some way that the mind works that can talk us out of what we sort of would admit is the best thing for ourselves. We would give fidelity and credence to the Torah and to these laws. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, and I can sort of think, well, what is this really all about? So maybe just like Shlomo, we also have to be cautious about, you know, what it is to overthink or to undercut the sort of the wisdom that we have received. And so not just for Shlomo, but for ourselves to discern between our intelligence and our wisdom. I don't mean to leave us on a note of like, it's not good to think about Judaism. That is not what I mean. But just with a certain cautionary that it does seem the rabbis want to poke us with, want to say just, because after all, some of the laws of the Torah, the reasons are given. So to say that they are not given so that we, because only two of them have reasons, there are others that have reason. In fact, we categorize our laws into two major categories, mishpatim, where the reasons can be understood, and then chukim, where they can't. And it's in that realm of the areas of the Torah that we don't always understand, but maybe the rabbis are warning us, try not to overthink it, because there is some higher wisdom to all of this that maybe your own wisdom will undermine.